This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Golf began when a couple of Scottish shepherds with low-tech clubs thought it might be fun to bat a rock around a field until it fell into a hole, or so I like to imagine. For better and worse, the game has evolved. James Dodson has played golf since childhood. As a reporter and author, he's won numerous awards for his writing about the game, and he's been associated with many of golf's greats. He co-wrote Arnold Palmer's memoir. That's no doubt why Dodson was sought after as a playing partner and luncheon guest by the man who said until quite recently that one of his primary jobs was making golf great again. Though they hadn't met, Dodson was aware of the fellow's impact on the game.
I knew Trump was very interested in golf. I knew he was buying up golf courses. His MO was to find a financially distressed property, buy it, keep it in bankruptcy, do a $500,000 renovation, fire the entire staff, and hire a third back.
So James Dodson, who grew up a Republican but currently describes his political stance as, quote, radical centrist, knew that. And maybe he thought that's all there was to know about Donald Trump. But that was before they'd met, which, as I've suggested, wasn't Dodson's idea.
This PR guy kept calling me and inviting me, and he kept saying things like, oh, Donald Trump loves your books. And I kept saying, Donald Trump doesn't read books, I've told, and he hadn't a clue who I am. Anyway, he called three or four times. Finally, I said yes.
That was 3 years ago, and Dodson probably wouldn't have regarded the invitation as an imposition if he hadn't had other plans. Dodson and his wife had arranged to visit Arnold Palmer at Palmer's home in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. From there, the Dodsons were headed to Scotland for some golf. Joining Donald Trump at his new course in North Carolina meant juggling those plans. But at his wife's urging, Dodson agreed to leave their home in Southern Pines, North Carolina, and drive to Charlotte, site of the recently reconstituted Trump National Charlotte Club, in order to meet with the Donald, who was not the only star attraction.
Greg Norman was going to show up, and he and Trump were going to play the first nine of the course. I was going to play with Eric, his son, a local congressman, and the guy I assumed was his bodyguard. And then we would swap at the nine holes. I would play with Trump and Greg, and then we would have a big lunch and hear all about the club.
When the big day arrived, a dark gray sky provided the first sign that all would not go as planned. Dodson was a little late arriving, and by the time he entered the Trump National Charlotte Clubhouse, his host was already holding forth.
Trump was strutting up and down, talking to his new members about how they were part of the greatest club in North Carolina. And when I first met him, I asked him how he was, you know, this is the journalist in me. I said, what are you using to pay for these courses? And he just sort of tossed off that he had access to $100
million. $100
million. So when I got in the car with Eric, as we were setting off, I said, Eric, who's funding? I know no banks because of the recession, the Great Recession, have touched a golf course. You know, no one's funding any kind of golf construction. It's dead in the water the last 4 or 5 years. And this is what he said. He said, well, we don't rely on American banks. We have all the funding we need out of Russia. I said, really? And he said, oh, yeah, we've got some guys that really love golf, and they're really invested in our programs. We just go there all the time. Now, that was 3 years ago, so it was pretty interesting.
Well, yeah, it is. Shortly after that conversation took place, James Dodson and Eric Trump teed off behind the foursome that included Donald Trump, and shortly after that, the promise of those clouds was fulfilled.
A bolt of lightning literally hit a house, and the rains came down, and we raced in our carts back to the clubhouse. And truthfully, I thought, you know, I'm going to be able to clear out of here now. This will be great. And I'm loading my clubs in the back of my car, thinking I'd get an early start back to Southern Pines for our trip to Latrobe. And this kid comes running out, Mr. Dodson, Mr. Trump really wants you to come in and have a cheeseburger. And I said, okay, I'll do it. And the kid pointed out they were really, really awesome cheeseburgers.
At lunch, Trump continued to celebrate the virtues of the Charlotte course and those of various other courses he'd bought or was about to buy. And the cheeseburgers? They were awesome. Tremendous, right?
You know, it was a cheeseburger. It was a platter of cheeseburgers.
Dodson listened politely to Trump's celebration of what he'd wrought, and when he'd finished his cheeseburger,
I said, well, I got to go. And Trump hopped up and he said, well, I'll walk you to the door. And he took my arm, a real bro hug, and we're crossing this long room, and he says, "You're the one that writes all the books." And I said, "Well, I've written a few." And he said, "I haven't read them because I really don't get much chance to read books, but I write books. Have you read my books?" I deadpanned. I said, "Yes, they're all stacked up on my bedside table. I haven't gotten to them yet." But he didn't seem to get the joke. And then we're walking in this bro hug. I mean, very snug. And he's a big guy. And he says, "So you're a journalist. You didn't get to ask me any questions. Ask me anything you want. I'm the most open interview you've ever had. I'll tell you anything. Straightest talker you've ever met."
Dodson tossed his host a couple of batting practice questions about golf courses, and then he tried a change-up.
So I said, "Are you going to run for president again?" Yeah, I'm thinking about it," he says. "You know, everywhere I go, people say to me, 'Trump, Trump, this country's totally effed up. You need to run for president. You're the only guy that could straighten it out. We need a businessman.'" He says, "What do you think? I ought to run?" And I said, "You'd be fun to follow." So he said, yeah, let me tell you. I'm thinking of doing it." And he said, "And I'll tell you what, I'll let you know if I do it." Now we're at the door, and he's still got me in the bro hug, and he says, "Come on, those are nothing. Those are softballs." And he says, "One more for the road. You know, give me something that's with some mustard." And this is what I said. "Well, okay, fair enough. My wife and I watched The Apprentice for the first time the other night in preparation for coming over here. And honestly, the question that kept popping up in my head is, are you as big an as you seem, or do you just play one on TV?" And this is what he did. He dropped my arm like it was, I'd caught fire spontaneously, stepped back at least a yard, made that kind of constipated, furious pig face he makes, slapped my back, doubled over, and popped up laughing like you can't believe, and declared, "Yeah, it's fun, isn't it?" You know, I liked the guy. I liked him. I mean, he was somebody you'd like to play golf with. He's got a good golf swing. He's apparently a pretty good golfer. He clearly loves the game. I'm kind of sorry I didn't get to play with him.
Dodson says his father, also a passionate golfer, had always celebrated playing golf with somebody as a grand way to get to know the person. Dodson, like his father, feels the game sometimes builds character and often reveals it. Alas, on that day at the Trump National Charlotte course, rain prevented that process of discovery. To understand the character of the future president of the United States, Dodson had only cheeseburgers, malarkey, and that bro hug to go on. Still, he's willing to draw some conclusions about his host from the encounter.
He's very beguilingly chummy, except for his handshake, which is sort of odd. He really does want you to like him. I mean, I think understanding Trump is that simple. He wants you to like him. He wants you to feel grateful that you belong to his club.
As he took his leave, Dodson explained to the future president that he had to prepare for his trip to La Trobe. "Who are you seeing there?" Trump asked. "Arnold Palmer," Dodson said. And he smiled broadly at that, Dodson told me. He crossed one finger over the other and he said, "Arnold and I are like that."
And I told Arnold that the next night at dinner, and he laughed and said, "Really, Shakespeare, it's more like this." And he crossed his hands and put them in his own throat.
Dodson thought Palmer's gesture was pretty funny, and it was, but perhaps it wasn't much of an overstatement. Arnold Palmer was the son of a greenskeeper. The way he saw it, golf should belong to whoever wanted to play it. As James Dodson has put it, Donald Trump celebrates golf as an aspirational game.
And by that, I mean something you achieve when you achieve success, and a measure of your success is you can belong to a very high-end country club. That the reason people should play it, they should get wealthy, and then golf would be the reward.
Through the 50s and 60s and 70s, Arnold Palmer, for whom Dodson has always had tremendous respect, popularized golf. His message seemed to be that if one determined kid in a working-class town in Pennsylvania could grow up to become, for a time, the most accomplished and popular golfer in the world, the game should be open to everybody inclined to give it a try. And that's the attitude to which James Dodson subscribes.
You know, there's three times as many public golf courses than private in America. That's the real soul of the game, and that's the way it was in Britain. And it's that way in America, too, by the way, with or without Donald Trump.
Mr. Trump would probably argue with that conclusion if he had the leisure to do so. He recently said he misses his former life as the man who would make golf great again. He's got more than golf and cheeseburgers on his plate these days. James Dodson's essay, The Man Who Would Be King, appears in his new book, The Range Bucket List, The Golf Adventure of a Lifetime. This weekend, Willie Mays turns 86. I know. I've talked about him a lot of times. It's his birthday. Cut me some slack. I first saw him when he was 24 or 25, from a distance. Not such a distance, though. My dad had gotten good seats in the polo grounds where the New York Giants used to play. Like Willie Mays, I wore a New York Giants uniform that day. He wore spikes. I wore sneakers. We both brought our gloves to the park, and he got to use his. The years went by. At one point a couple of decades ago, I was supposed to interview him, and it didn't work out. Somebody told me it was just as well. More years went by. For a book, I wrote some doggerel about Willie Mays. A little earlier, a friend of mine had written a terrific biography of Willie, and through that friend, I established a correspondence with a woman named Renee Anderson, who helps Willie out with his travel and various commitments. He doesn't see as well as he used to. He doesn't see well at all. Anyway, through Renee, I got the doggerel to Willie, and she reported that he'd liked it. That was encouragement enough. Each May since that happened, I've written something more to celebrate the birthday of the game's greatest player. I did it again this year. I wrote, "Time beats our bodies, dims our sight, slows down what once was fast. The skills we knew as effortless were never built to last. But know that for the ones who saw you run and throw and hit, the years that have rolled on since then have never dimmed a bit the wonder of those summer days. I'll bet they never will. We smiled at what you showed us, and today we're smiling still." I just heard back from Renee Anderson. "As is his way," she wrote, "he cocked his head to catch your words with his better ear. He listened silently, and then he had me repeat it. His review, he writes pretty good. You thank him." You're welcome, Mr. Mays. Happy birthday. Every 4 years, homeless children from around the world compete in the Street Child World Cup. In 2014, Chantel Taylor represented the U.S.
And a lot of people kind of didn't know why I was there. Like, how are you homeless? Like, you're from the United States.
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR. E.E. Morris left the following review of Only a Game on iTunes. "I've found my people. I'm a fan who doesn't just love the sport itself. I love the stories behind the sports, fans, and athletes, and I get those from Only a Game. Thanks, Bill, Karen, Charlie, the whole team for being the best hour of my week." Thank you, E.E., for being the best fan of Only a Game, or at least tied for best with everybody else who's contributed a review of the show. Consider visiting iTunes and leaving a review of your own. It's the best way to help other listeners find our show. I'm Bill Littlefield, and it's time for three stories you should know. This week, we're going to talk about marijuana. My guests are Patrick Ruby of Vice Sports via Skype and Cindy Bourne of The Washington Post. Welcome back to both of you.
Hi, nice to be here.
We're talking about marijuana. Vice Sports has to be represented.
Cindy, you get to kick this one off.
Patrick and I will play the roles of Harold and Kumar today. This is actually a very serious topic, and I don't mean to treat it in any other way. You know, the NFL is now facing an issue, a crisis, really, of opioid abuse that's, frankly, not really any different than ordinary America. Players are playing a game that is incredibly painful, so they're looking for anything. And, you know, the NFL, over the years, has pushed prescription drugs, Toradol, for instance, and these have long-range effects that really wreak havoc on the system. And players are turning increasingly to marijuana. And this is a new science, but it's being shown to have an effect on alleviating pain. And you're seeing people like Stephen Jones and Jerry Jones from the Dallas Cowboys coming out and saying, you know, it's time the NFL looks at this marijuana ban. Now, Roger Goodell's on the other side of the fence. He's still sort of taking the stance that it's addictive, more study needs to be done. And we'll see. I mean, clearly it would have to be negotiated into the collective bargaining agreement. But if you care about the people, then you're going to want what would be the safest way for them to seek pain relief.
It's an issue not just in the NFL. It's kind of across sports, and really it's across society. Up until the 40s, it was in the U.S. pharmacopoeia. And when it went into these drug laws, we went into sort of the Reefer Madness era. American doctors were saying, don't do this. Don't put this on the schedule. But of course it did for other reasons. And that's a different podcast and a different radio show. But I mean, basically, the sports leagues are sort of reacting and are sort of behind the times, just as society is. And I think with someone like Roger Goodell, I don't know what he really believes, but I think the leagues are just sort of hesitant to make full-on moves until they see all of society and not just certain states in the U.S. making a full-on move.
You know, he's not going to want to give any ground on this with the players without getting something in return. I mean, this is a negotiation, and it will be a couple of years down the line, most likely. But, you know, that's not too far off.
Well, that's disgusting. I mean, if we're talking about a negotiation involving people's health, I find that deplorable. But do you think ultimately we're going to reach a point where players are recognized as the best sources of what they should do in order to alleviate their pain?
Yeah, I think so. And I think especially when you've got the Drug Enforcement Administration looking into the NFL doctors and how they prescribe drugs, you're seeing these guys, you know, our heroes, when they retire, they're limping around, they're in pain, they die. And I think when you look at the idea that there's something safer available, I think people are becoming more and more receptive.
But in the meantime, I think they'd be very smart to at least adopt a don't ask, don't tell policy, where stop testing for this, stop suspending people for it, just don't do anything.
Okay, I want to talk a little about baseball statistics. The measurement of a player's value has come a long way in my long lifetime. We used to just be able to talk about wins and earned run average when we talked about pitchers. Batting average, runs batted in, and home runs, that was enough to evaluate a hitter. This week, I read an article by Adam Willis for Slate, and it suggests that the next leap forward might be a way to measure team chemistry, and more specifically, to assign a number value to the extent to which a player makes his teammates better. And I think I hate this idea. It's too new for me to be completely sure. But some matters, it seems to me, should remain subjective, even in a game so thoroughly drenched in statistics as baseball is. Cindy, you go along with this, or do you like the idea of science measuring how well a player makes his teammates better?
I'm with you on this, Bill. I'm just not sure it's possible. It's not high school chemistry. It's team chemistry. And, it, you know, who knows what makes for good chemistry? Mm. You can take the most volatile people and you can have the most successful team imaginable. And you can have a team like, for instance, the Nationals here in Washington, who were clicking and doing everything really well. And then they bring in a guy like Jonathan Papelbon and it just completely upsets the clubhouse.
I could have told him that would happen.
Did you have an algorithm for that?
I just watched the Red Sox.
see, exactly. You don't need an algorithm for it.
Patrick, what about you? You ready to stand up for science?
No, well, here's my thing. I am ready to stand up for science. And this does not sound scientific at all. That's the problem with it. I'd like to hear a lot more about what are you actually trying to quantify? What are you actually measuring? They call economics the dismal science, right? The reason they call it that is because ultimately it is the study of human behavior and psychology, and humans are infinitely unpredictable and difficult when it comes to our behavior to figure out what we're going to do tomorrow.
You know, two things occur to me on this. One is what fun it would be to be a fly on the wall when an agent comes into negotiations and says, look at these stats that show that my guy is going to make your whole team so much better just by being a terrific influence in the clubhouse. I can't wait to hear the response to that. The other thing that I'm thinking of is an old friend of mine who passed on some years ago named Lenny Marullo. He was a longtime baseball scout, and he used to tell me that he could tell how good a player was by watching him get off the bus. And I kind of like that, you know? I kind of like that. Oh, yeah, I know what this kid's going to be. I don't have to see him do anything but get off the bus.
I thought we lived through Moneyball to get away from that. Are we full circle? Time really is a flat circle. Jesus.
All right, Patrick, I understand that you have some good news for us, and we're certainly ready for that.
I do. My story involves FIBA, and that's not the international soccer organization that exists for extravagant bribes and also the World Cup. That's FIFA. I'm talking about FIBA, which is basketball's international governing body. This week, they announced as of October, they're no longer going to ban players from wearing religious head coverings on the court. It's a pretty significant move, because before this, players with strong religious beliefs didn't have any options. You know, we had a story on this at Vice Sports. We profiled a former University of Memphis women's basketball player who wanted to play pro in Europe. Because she's Muslim, she wanted to wear a hijab, and she couldn't do it. But when you look at the change, it does raise a question, which is, why was this even a rule in the first place? FIBA says this was a, quote, safety precaution. But there's no actual evidence that any player was ever hurt during a game because of headgear. It still took 2 years for FIFA having a trial period to make a decision here. I understand people are touchy about mixing politics, religion, sports. But this wasn't like somebody holding a calf with masks in the middle of a game. And it's not like some simple head cover is like wearing spiked pads in American football.
Kind of oppression, you know, helmet.
This is a very simple expression of faith. The only thing I can figure is that this took a while because of fear and prejudice. So I'm happy and I'm hopeful because I think some good come out of this. You know, when we talk about fear and prejudice and someone who might see religious headgear and feel threatened, what better way to realize this is actually safe and this is actually fine than seeing people play basketball in it?
I think that's an excellent point. Cindy, you have anything good to say about FIBA?
I do, actually. And I don't know why, but there seems to be a general movement of Muslim women toward working out and toward sports competition. I've profiled a couple of times a young girl, 17-year-old girl from Minnesota named Amaya Zafar, who fell in love with boxing. And she has tried and tried and tried to get bouts and has not been able to, because until recently, the U.S. Boxing Association said you couldn't, you know, part of hijab isn't just the headgear, it's having your whole body covered. And the rules specify that refs have to be able to see if you've had injuries to your body. USA Boxing is now saying, you know what, I think in another couple of months, we're just going to take that off the books. It's just silly. But, you know, you have, you saw in the London Olympics and again in the Rio Olympics, a number of women who were competing while wearing hijab, including a fencer from the U.S. who ended up winning a medal. You have Nike now launching its pro hijab line because, of course, there's a buck to be made there.
Right, of course. That's what you know, it's true progress.
Well, yeah, frankly, you know, you do. And you have women who are running marathons. It's just becoming less and less of a big deal. And Amaya Zafar was telling me, I'm devout, my religion is important to me, but so are sports, and I should be able to have both of those.
Again, if it's not giving someone an advantage and it's not hurting anybody, it seems totally harmless. And it seems like, what would you rather have? These stupid rules? Or would you have rather more people competing in sports? And I think the answer is pretty clear.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Patrick Ruby of Vice Sports and Cindy Boren of The Washington Post. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thanks, Bill.
Always a pleasure, Bill.
Soccer. It may not seem like the obvious way to improve the lives of people emerging from homelessness and addiction, but that's what Street Soccer USA has been doing since 2004. The program now fields teams in 16 U.S. cities. Only a Game's Martin Kessler has the story of one of those teams.
17-year-old Chantel Payton is the second oldest of five children.
I'm kind of like the protector. Like, even though they've like seen what I've seen, I don't want them to experience it worse than me. Like, if anything, I'd want me to experience it, like, the worst.
When you talk about the stuff that you've seen, could you describe sort of what that is?
All I can really say is, like, things that no kid should really see. Like, that I would not want any kid, doesn't matter, like, 15, 16, to ever see.
Growing up, Chantel and her siblings lived with their grandparents. She says her mom was in and out. Around 2010, Chantel's mom moved into a transitional housing program for adults who had been in homeless shelters or rehab centers. She was recovering from addiction. Chantel and her siblings joined their mom at the facility outside Sacramento. Chantel liked living there. There were lots of other kids.
Like, all the kids knew where I was coming from. We all came from, like, somewhat of the same background, so we all kind of just connected.
Around the same time, another resident named Lisa Reitzman was trying to start a soccer team. Reitzman was a former college player. She was also recovering from addiction. When she moved into the transitional housing, she realized Sacramento had a street soccer team for men, but not for women. So she decided to start one. And if she wanted to recruit women, she was certain of one thing. Children had to be welcome at practices.
It was like a difficult thing to try to get someone to watch your kids while you go to a meeting or go play soccer. So the idea was like they could bring their kids to this.
That's how Chantel and her siblings ended up at the very first practice for the Sacramento Lady Salamanders. The idea was that the kids would sit and watch while their moms practiced. But when the Peyton kids started wrestling on the sideline, Reitzman realized that plan wasn't going to work.
I think it's one of those things where they're either going to be really distracting on the sideline or you, like, include them.
So Reitzman invited Chantel and her siblings to scrimmage against their mom and the five other players.
You know, there's, like, these older ladies kind of trying to figure out, like, how to stop the ball. And then you got these kids just, like, blasting his shots in the goal and making it look really easy.
So the Peyton kids came back with their mom to Reitzman's second practice. And then the third practice. And the fourth.
Yeah, I mean, they were there every time. They love soccer. Like, it was a way for them to play, like, as much as they could. And we weren't going to tell them not to.
Chantel says those practices were important.
It was like a different vibe when we would go there. We kind of connected better than we would have, I think, without having some type of outlet to come together and do something as a family.
After that first season, Reitzman got an administrative job at a nearby college, but she continued to lead the Lady Salamanders. Chantel's family moved into their own place, and her mom started working as a personal trainer. As Chantel's siblings got older, they gravitated to other sports, but Chantel stuck with soccer.
When I step on the field, I just feel like a brand new person. And then, like, when I shoot the goal, it's like a feeling like I've never really felt before. It's like freedom.
And that brings us to an event called the Street Child World Cup. Every 4 years, the World Cup host country holds a competition for children who have been homeless. In 2014, Reitzman nominated Chantel to join the U.S. team in Brazil. Chantel's mom told her daughter the good news.
And I was, like, super excited. And I was like, yes, I want to go. And she was like, okay, well, you have to get all your stuff from your teachers, all your homework. And I was like, okay.
Chantel had never left the country. But in Brazil, she met boys and girls from Zimbabwe, Burundi, the Philippines, and 15 other countries. Some of the kids were surprised to see Chantel and her U.S. teammates.
And a lot of people kind of didn't know why I was there. Like, how are you homeless? Like, you're from the United States. Like, I was really shocked. I was like, I don't know.
The kids shared their stories. One Indian boy told Chantel how he spent his days working for pocket change to help his family and how he saw his dad abuse his mom.
It made me kind of think back to, like, my life and, like, how much I took for granted because, like, I've came from that type of stuff, but it wasn't as bad as what I was hearing from, like, other kids from around the world. The stuff that they went through kind of made me more, like, grateful for even just, like, the littlest things. Like, having clothes, even though they weren't, like, super name brand little things. Having my mom back, yeah.
Chantel says as soon as she got back to the U.S., she gave all her siblings big hugs and started crying. She says the trip made her more hopeful. She started dreaming about playing college soccer, and she kept playing for her high school team. Meanwhile, Reitzman started working full-time for the street soccer organization in Sacramento. Last year, the group added a youth team for kids from low-income neighborhoods. Reitzman says it was hard finding committed coaches who cared more about teaching life lessons than they did about soccer.
And Chantel, I ran into her. I was like, hey, Chantel, what are you up to? She's like, well, I go to school, and then I have a job I don't really like. And I'm like, oh, my God, like, come coach. Come coach with me. Like, you have to coach with me.
Chantel said she'd do it. But as you can probably tell, she can sometimes be low-key.
Didn't have any questions. She's just like, yeah, that sounds fun. And so I wasn't really sure, like, if she'd show up or not. And the first day we had, like, an opportunity to coach, like, she was at my doorstep, like, early, ready to go. She has been, like, the most committed.
Chantel says the kids inspire her. She knows that a lot of them are dealing with tough situations at home, but they still show up to practice early.
When the kids want me to be on their team, that makes me, like, the happiest. When they're like, I want Coach Chantel, I want Coach Chantel. And I'm like, aw.
Chantel is getting ready to graduate from high school. She says her mom is doing well. So are her siblings. She's next planning to head to a junior college, then a four-year school. She's thinking about becoming a social worker.
What do you hope that, you know, people who hear your story, what do you hope that they take away from it?
That anybody can help somebody.
That's Chantel Payton speaking with Only a Game's Martin Kessler. You can find links to the Sacramento Lady Salamanders and Street Soccer USA at onlyagame.org. A few months ago, high school football player Gary Gibbs did something that made his coach say,
Gary? you know, of all people, Gary, really?
What did Gary do? That's just ahead on Only a Game, and you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, what was meant to be tough love in Nairobi's biggest slum brings soccer to 25,000 children a year. But now it's time for my conversation with Charlie Pierce about this week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
One of the week's most significant sports stories, and it's a multi-part story, happened just down the street at Fenway Park. Adam Jones of the Baltimore Orioles was the victim of racial slurs at Fenway on Monday, and a couple of days later, a fan got himself tossed out for similarly insulting the woman who'd sung the national anthem. Are we looking at isolated incidents?
I think we're looking at idiots who should be isolated, but this has been a historic endemic problem in the Boston fan base. I'm not saying it's not historic and endemic elsewhere in the country, because it is. I mean, this kind of thing is America's original sin, as they say. But it's unfortunate that it erupted again in Boston because of both the city and the team's sad history of this whole thing. You know, in the early 2000s and the late 1990s, when Pedro Martinez and Manny Ramirez and David Ortiz were the stars, and you had Dominican flags and people singing in two languages at Fenway, I thought it was like this wonderful cleansing, you know, breeze that blew through. But we are in a period of reaction, and this is going to happen.
By scoring 39 points in Game 2 of the Eastern Conference semifinals, LeBron James passed Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and moved into second place on the postseason points list. After that game, DeMar DeRozan of the Toronto Raptors said he would pay $100 to anyone who can find somebody to guard LeBron. Where's an NBA player going to find $100?
That's great. It's like, you know, I would give a Buffalo nickel for. Yeah. But if DeMar DeRozan wants to give me $100, I'll guard LeBron James. I won't do a very good job. He will get his 90 points.
University of Alabama head coach Nick Saban got a raise this week.
No kidding. Well, I'm very happy for him.
From now until 2024, he will be paid a little bit over $11 million a year. And to tide him over until that new contract actually kicks in, he got a $4 million signing bonus. Do you suppose he threatened to leave?
Wow, Nick Saban could hire the 5th Armored Division to guard LeBron James.
Just out of curiosity, is there anything you wouldn't sign if you could get a $4 million bonus for signing? I mean, a contract with Satan, maybe not, but anything else?
Like voting for the president's reelection, I'd have to think.
The Edmonton Oilers had a problem at Game 3 of their NHL playoff series against the Anaheim Ducks on Sunday evening. Long lines outside the men's rooms. That was the problem. Management figured they could solve the problem by converting a couple of ladies' rooms into men's rooms. What could possibly go wrong?
Well, have they noticed that, like, women go to hockey games?
Apparently not.
It's remarkable, this being Edmonton and all. This was not a smart play by somebody in facilities management. Can you imagine, by the way, just for a second, how much beer you have to sell to overtax the men's room facilities in an NHL arena in Canada?
Tony Romo, late of the Dallas Cowboys, is going to try to make it as a pro golfer. His route to that goal goes through the U.S. Open qualifiers. Not an easy thing to try to do.
No, but it's, you know, a logical progression. A lot of athletes, you know, there are several retired professional athletes on the senior tour. They're always playing in the celebrity events. So good luck to him. I mean, I just hope that, you know, when he gets within like 3 inches of the hole and is, you know, putting for eagle, he doesn't like drop the ball out of his pocket or something.
That was cruel.
I know. It's football.
The New England Patriots are attempting to trademark the phrase unequivocally the sweetest. That's because owner Robert Kraft said the team's most recent Super Bowl win was, quote, unequivocally the sweetest. Is he unequivocally the greediest?
I'm surprised he hasn't tried to trademark wow and yippee and holy
hooray,
cow.
We won.
And we won.
Finally, Charlie, the Sports Illustrated website ran a contest this week. They put up 20 tweets, and the idea was to guess which tweets had come from Donald Trump and which had come from Jose Canseco. You want to take a couple of guesses?
Sure.
Okay, here goes. Druggie at A-Rod is now scheming to sue the Yankees. He will go down as the biggest sports embarrassment of all time. What do you think?
That depends. How's embarrassment spelled?
Two R's, two S's.
Okay, it's got to be Jose.
No, it was Trump.
Oh, man, what an upset.
Number two.
Okay.
Because we don't recycle and consume like crazy, icicles are non-existent. Titanic would still have existed today.
Jose.
Yeah, you got that one right.
Titanic being sunk by an icicle is a nice thing.
Okay, how about this one? No doubt Tom Brady is the GOAT, that is greatest of all time.
Trump.
Nope, Canseco.
Boy, I'm no good at this at all.
You want to try one more?
One more, because right. I'm really doing well.
Watch commodity prices soar because of the freezing cold. We could use some global warming.
Canseco.
Trump.
Damn!
You did about like I did. I got 12 out of 20.
Is it good or bad that we're wrong about this stuff?
I am going to have to leave that for the listeners to decide. You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pearson, Sports Illustrated, from time to time, and he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
You gotta be tough to play football, right? You gotta be aggressive. Only a Game's Karen Given has a story that suggests otherwise.
Gary Gibbs is a quiet, shy sort of person. Or at least, that's what everyone tells me.
He looks like a football player. He's a big guy. But he's just a thoughtful, gentle soul. Like, he doesn't have a lot to say.
He's not the guy that's the rah-rah, you know, come on, guys, let's do this kind of thing. You know, that's just not his way. He's just G.
He's very shy, kind of a man of few words. But a few months back, Gary did something that made his coach say,
Gary? you know, of all people, Gary, really?
Let's back up a bit.
I know I'm not the best football player. I know this for a fact. I'm not even the best person on the line last year.
That's Gary. He's a junior and the starting center for the football team at Jeremiah E. Burke High School in Boston. For the past 6 years, Byron Beeman has coached the team at the Burke. When he started, the program was in pretty bad shape.
Nobody knew where, like, a football was. There was about literally 10 helmets and honestly about 13 pairs of shoulder pads. So, you know, yeah, you can imagine, like, my first head coaching job at a high school, and I'm walking into that, and I'm like, okay, this is just going to take some work.
Coach Beeman got right to it. He found a nonprofit that would supply the team with uniforms and helmets and shoulder pads and footballs.
I'm not afraid to ask for help. You know, if there are grants to apply for, I'm going to try to find them. And the worst that people can tell me is no.
The Burke and its surrounding neighborhood are well known in Boston, but not really in a good way. The school temporarily lost its accreditation in the mid-90s. It's undergone a renovation and a lot of improvements since then. But metal detectors were reinstalled at the front doors last year after a student was shot and killed near the school. Coach Beeman says he sometimes stays up late at night applying for grants and other aid, and he's been able to pull together enough equipment to field a team. But enough isn't good enough.
The kids deserve the best. They shouldn't be looked at as if, at like, okay, well, they live in this particular community, so we don't have to give them the best that we can possibly provide. I think that that's not fair to them.
In order to have enough players to field a team, Beeman has to draw students from four different high schools. Gary attends the Community Academy for Science and Health, CASH for short. Beeman knows that most of his players aren't going to play football after high school, so he spends a lot of time talking to his athletes about how they can be good citizens, good students, good sons, and eventually good fathers. Gary must have been paying close attention on the day Coach Beeman delivered this message.
You're going to meet people in your life that are influential people and people that can help you and help those around you. And when you have that opportunity, you have to speak up. You have to step up, speak up, and be a leader in that moment because it's not just about you.
And that brings us back to the thing Gary Gibbs did that got everyone talking.
I'm just going to start from the beginning.
Sure.
So I take AP Bio, and every Thursday we had to go down to Harvard Medical. And at Harvard Medical, we run, like, simulations, and they teach us about, like what happens in the human body. And, yeah, that's basically what we do down there.
It's a lab, and students from Boston schools get to go in and take part in a live-action emergency room simulation.
That's Lauren Baker. She's the First Lady of Massachusetts. She came to watch Gary and his classmates run through the simulations that day. When it was all over,
I see her, like, about to leave, and I just, like, hop up.
That's when Gary Gibbs asked Lauren Baker if he could walk her out of the building.
You know, they had just introduced me to this whole crowd of kids as, you know, this is the First Lady of Massachusetts, ooh, you know. And the nerve it must have taken for him to stand up and come over to me. No one else did. So, of course, I said, sure.
And I ask her, oh, do you know any programs that would want to donate football equipment to my football team? Because, I mean, we have enough, but we could definitely need more.
The Bakers have two sons who played high school football. So Lauren Baker says she knows all about the benefits of playing a sport and being part of a team.
Gary told me that he felt like for a lot of the kids, football was the reason they weren't hanging out on the streets during the afternoons, you know, so he felt like it was really important that they build their football program at the Burke School. I was so impressed with him that my heart just went to him immediately. You know, of course, I will do whatever it takes to help you because you are special. I told Gary that, you know, I've got no cash on me, but I want to help you. He sort of looked at me like, all right, you know, whatever.
I didn't know it was going to work. I wasn't expecting the email back.
Baker took a picture with Gary. Gary says it's pretty cool to have a selfie with the governor's wife. And she sent an email to a friend of hers.
And the subject simply said, how can I help this kid? ?
That's Christy Keswick.
And I open it up and there's a selfie of the First Lady and Gary staring back at me. And I'm like, who is this kid and what is she talking about?
Keswick is the co-founder of Good Sports, a nonprofit based in Massachusetts that provides sports equipment to kids. Their donations impact about 1 million athletes all across the country every year.
It is a great story because what are the chances that a kid who's walking her out is asking her for sports equipment and she knows somebody who does exactly that in the same city?
Gary had all but forgotten his 2-minute conversation with the First Lady when a couple of weeks later, he got called into the principal's office.
That was like the last thing on my mind when I got called up there. So I didn't know what was going on.
The principal had Gary open up an email. It said that the Burke football team had been awarded an equipment grant from Good Sports. Coach Beeman was shocked.
Players probably have asked, you know, maybe a cousin or uncle or something like that, you know, for $10, $15 or whatever. but never had a player who had an opportunity to meet the governor's wife and say, you know what, I'm going to walk you outside. And as I'm walking you outside, guess what? I want to know if you know anybody that can help my football team. No.
A couple of months later, Good Sports came through with $7,500 in new equipment. Footballs, a portable tackle wheel, even cleats donated by the New England Patriots.
And then we got them practice jerseys, which they've never had. A lot of people will say, well, you know what? That's not necessary to play that sport, is it? But what we've learned is that self-esteem and the feeling of somebody cares enough about me and now we feel united as a team, something like that goes actually a lot further than most people actually would think.
The day that Good Sports delivered all the equipment and sort of put it on display at the Burke School was so much fun. Gary came and maybe 10 or 15 other players.
I even had to speak. That was ugh. But I mean, also with that ugh, it was just like great.
The kids were so excited. And I think I was probably the most excited of anybody because I just couldn't believe how much great stuff there was.
From going from not knowing I was going to get it to finding out that I was going to get it and then thinking that I was going to get the minimum and then actually getting close to the maximum was just really just to me.
Describe.
I feel like I owe a lot to the team and to the coaches and to everybody that like helps out with the team. And feeling the sensation that I actually gave back to them was just jaw-dropping. Like, I really liked that feeling.
They asked me to say a few words to the team, and I said, you know, Gary stepped up on your behalf, and here is the result of his having the courage to do that. And I want you to know that you all have the ability to do the same thing. And when you see an opportunity like that, you should take it. I don't know if it sunk in for anybody, but definitely sunk in for Gary.
You know, hearing this story, I'm a little bit worried that after it airs, there are going to be high school kids all across the state who suddenly want to walk you out and ask you for something.
Well, you never know unless you ask, right?
I'm not convinced that Gary is as quiet and shy as everyone says he is, but Gary Gibbs is most certainly humble.
I just had a 2-minute conversation. That's all I did. I'm just the starting point. They really just like did up all the way up there.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal and our senior producer is Karen Given. We say goodbye this week to our intern Ryan Fitzgerald, who's leaving us so that he can go graduate from LaSalle College. Some excuse. I kid. Best of luck, Ryan. Thank you for the good work. Our final word comes from Coach Byron Beeman, who tells us about his favorite nickname for Gary Gibbs.
I've been calling him G-Money since ninth grade, you know, and then I added bags to it, so he's G-Money Bags.
G-Money Bags, yeah. That reminds me what the coaches used to call me in the ninth grade. Never mind. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week for more Sports NPR Style on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.